My name is Mark Schwang, and I'd like to welcome you all to this evening's forum, which is entitled, How Can We Unplug the Christmas Machine? I'd like to explain a little bit about forums here at Holden, and then just a little bit about the genesis of this evening's topic, and then introduce our two distinguished panelists, who will start us off in conversation. First, a word about forums. For those of you who are new to Holden or new to this year's forum series, forums, unlike sessions, are primarily conversational in mode. The point is to explore together some subject or question or controversial topic. The point is to explore together in a way that adds up to something like an inquiry, where we all learn more about the complexities of a certain situation, a certain problem, and tonight, really, a certain kind of practical question. Namely, given that we recognize, to some degree or another, a certain problem, what can we begin to do, or what are folks already doing about unplugging the Christmas machine? Just a word now about the genesis of this question. As most of you have gathered, even those of you who may have arrived today, this week at Holden Village is leading up to Saturday, which will be Christmas in July, an annual Holden event. And you noticed in worship this week, we've had Advent theme of preparation, theme of expectation, and it provides us, as we heard from one of the homilists early in the week, Dan Erlander, this week provides us here at the Village an opportunity to reflect on the meaning of Christmas absent the normally frantic and somewhat anxiety-inducing context in which we normally not only think about, but celebrate and live through and liturgically re-experience the meaning of that central event in the life of the church. And the hope would be that we together here this evening and throughout the week can do those things absent this frantic context in which we often experience Christmas. Tonight, really, then, we're going to be focusing on the frantic context, the kind of anxiety-inducing framework in which many of us annually grope towards some understanding of the meaning of Christmas by overcoming several obstacles, namely the whole situation in which the event and the celebration arises and what our culture has made of it. So our two panelists will help get us started. They're not to be construed here as experts on a kind of nightline where we kind of turn to them and go back and forth with questions and answers. Their point is just to throw out some ideas and to get the conversation going. And let me introduce them briefly. To my immediate right is Joan Hunt, who most of you already know. She's completing a third week here on teaching staff, and she's been very active as well in the worship life of the community. And she is currently a campus pastor at Portland State University. And then Tim Walbrecht, who is formerly on the teaching staff, here as a guest this year. Tim is the founder of the St. Luke's Health Ministries in Bellevue, Washington, and currently the director of the Counseling Center for the St. Luke Medical Center, also in Bellevue. And I guess I won't try to anticipate what they're going to say, but let them just say it, and let's give some thought to what they say, but give some thought then to how we can all contribute to this kind of thorny question. So I think Joan's going to start us off.
It took me about 35 years to figure out why I had a love-hate relationship with Christmas. The love relationship with Christmas had to do with the message of the Word becoming flesh to dwell among us, with a great gift of God's presence and support, with hearing year after year the stories of longing and waiting during the season of Advent, and then welcoming this one who came with no violence, in fact, vulnerable into our world. That's why I love Christmas. But after a few years of therapy, when I was in my mid-30s, I discovered that the reason I hated Christmas was because when I was 2.5 years old and my mother was at the hospital giving birth to the second child in the family, my younger sister, and her birthday's Christmas Eve, and the Christmas tree was up at home, and at 2.5 it was really the first time that I had any mental image of what Christmas was. I could recognize trees, I could say the words, Christmas is coming. I was probably beginning to learn the songs in Sunday school. It was that year, while my mother was at the hospital giving birth to my sister on Christmas Eve, that my father molested me for the first time. And so, so Christmas, my first Christmas I was aware of, was the advent of terrific violence in my life. Violence that continued for many years, and then that I forgot about after the abuse stopped, and was in my mid-30s before I remembered again. Now, I think you're going to say that that kind of violence connected with Christmas is not that unusual in American families. But since that's his expertise, I'll talk about the other kind of violence that our way of celebrating Christmas perpetrates in our society. And I'm thinking particularly of systemic violence, or the kind of violence that we do to people who are poor, to people who have an image of how Christmas ought to be celebrated that's promulgated on television and radio and newspapers and magazines and in the stores that they pass, from the ones, the big stores, department stores downtown, to the small corner drug stores or 7-Elevens that they might go to, saying, spend, 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 and this is how to do it right. At Christmas time, we do economic violence in our country by the way that we spend it. And I was looking for some figures and couldn't find them in the time I had today, but I know that stores depend on their revenue in December, and if they don't have a good shopping period between Thanksgiving and Christmas, you know, the whole year is ruined for them, because that makes it or breaks it for them. So we all join into this frenzy of buying and buying and buying, those of us who can afford it, those of us who can ill afford it, and even those of us who can't afford it. There's a group in Ellensburg, Georgia, I have the address with me, I'll put it on the board later, called Alternatives, that has gotten very interested in studying this, and they publish materials that some of us may use in our congregations. But they're the ones who are responsible for the little bulletin inserts that say, Jesus came for the poor, will you? Or that show pictures of the three wise men standing perplexed at where should they go? Is it this place where Santa Claus is being worshipped? Or is it this tiny, humble, ill-lit little manger where the Christ child has been laid? And so groups like that remind me and suggest for me ways that I could live with more economic justice in my life. And if we all did that, then maybe we could take back Christmas. Christmas does economic violence to people. It does violence to people's self-image because of the economics of the system, whether you're on the side that can or can't afford it. And therefore, it also does spiritual violence, because it holds up an image of a God who blesses us with money, which we are to spend, to use, to make ourselves fat and happy. But Jesus came for the poor. and so will we. The book, Unplug the Christmas Machine, How to Have the Christmas You've Always Wanted, is written by a woman from Portland, Jo Robinson, and Jean Staley, her co-writer. And they've come up with a Christmas pledge, which is on the board behind me, that you can read. I also wanted to read their list of four basic things that children want for Christmas, based on their extensive interviews with children over a 10-year period. They would be quick, children would be quick, of course, to give a list that started with this toy, this record, that CD, and on and on and on. But the four things they say that children really want and need are relaxed and loving time with the family, realistic expectations about gifts, an evenly paced holiday season, and strong family traditions. Every year I try to be a little more aware of how I live Christmas and the way I take care of the wounded child that I was, who's still inside me and cries out, and also with the way that I can help bring peace to victims in our society, to people who suffer from the way that we live. I hope we'll be swapping a lot of ideas about that.
Thank you. We have never met until this evening, so.
Hello.
At lunchtime, Mark and Dorothy sat at the table where I was for a purpose, I understand, and that was to find out if I was doing anything at 9 o'clock tonight. Guess I'm not. Well, I'm now. But anyway, I'm a ELCA clergy, and I'm also a therapist, and it has come to my attention in a number of years that I've been doing therapy work with people, working with them through their journeys and so forth, that right around the end of October, first part of November, there's a very much increase in their state of state of anxiety in their personal being. And so through the years, I have worked with people around this whole aspect of what it means for them for the holiday season. And in fact, I found a great increase, not so much to my enjoyment all the time, of a number of people coming in to work through some basic issues, some real basic primary issues. And what I try to get them to do, and I throw these suggestions out to you, I try to get them to ask some basic questions. And the basic questions that I don't want them to ask is, you know, what am I buying everybody? Or I have 2 days here at Holden till Christmas, have I bought all my gifts? And what am I planning for the big dinner and so forth and so on? But I try to get people to focus on such questions as, what is it that I find difficult with this time of year? And this starts unleash, and they begin to, once they get to that safe place, are able to unfold before themselves their story, similar to what Joan shared at the very beginning, that there's aspects of this holiday season that are not very pleasant. And it could be the aspect of what happened to me at that time, or sometime years ago in my childhood, or it could be the whole aspect that I, that whenever I get with my family for any type of gathering, it is a very unpleasant experience with either bad memories or flashbacks or so forth. And I think one of the first things we need to do is ask that question, what is it that I find difficult with this time of year? And then a similar question would be, what is it about this time of year, the event, the situation, the gathering, that affects me as it does? Followed by, how does it actually affect me? And there are very many physical symptoms that people begin to have during this time, and we see a lot of those in our medical clinic. And then with that, and with those questions, it's a process, I believe, of demythologizing, whatever, I can never pronounce it, I'm not going to try it now either. The idea that the American family is a safe place for everybody. And when I mean safe place, I mean a safe place spiritually. And there's a certain myth that we have that at the holiday times, everybody can sort of forget what's ever gone on within this family. We all kind of meet together and carve up the ham and turkey and exchange the gifts, which get returned in 2 days anyway, and so forth and so on, and kind of live through this time. So I believe we have to really face the process, and I think that there's a lot that the church can do for that, and I think there's a lot that we, as we face our own stuff and so forth, that we can do about that too. And that is realizing that it isn't necessarily, a family's not necessarily a safe place spiritually. What I mean by spiritually, I'm a believer that anything that has ever happened in any type of form of abuse, whether it be physical, sexual, verbal, emotional, so forth and so on, including spiritual abuse, they all come down to one basic aspect, and that's the core of spiritual abuse, because spiritual abuse affects the core of our being, and all other types of abuse affects the core of who we are. So when I say spiritual abuse, I'm taking in all the long list of types of abuse that are out there. So we need to begin to ask the right questions, and we need to look at that American family is not necessarily a safe place. And I believe we also have to look at our language, the language that comes out during this time. And I had written some words up there, but she had a lot better stuff to put up there, so it's okay. But I came up with six, and I'm willing to listen to other ones too. These are six that I came up with. The word always needs to not be used during that holiday time, as in, well, we've always done it this way before, we've always put the tree in this car, we've always had everybody over, we've always done so forth and so on. The other word is must. Well, I must go home, or I must have the family over, I must join with the family, or I must do this and so forth. Another one would be have to. I have to do this, I have to do that. If we start getting away from some of these key words, or noticing when we start using them, from about November on, I think we start moving in the right direction. Other ones would include such words as everyone, or all people, including us, and every time. See, every time we get together, we have such a marvelous time. Well, every time we get together, Uncle Henry passes out in a corner, his face falls into the mashed potatoes and so forth, but no one seems to notice. Those are the types of things we have to start taking a look at. And I work with people that have difficulty at the holiday times. I work with them on what I call protection plans. That after they really start to speak the truth, and they do come to the conclusion that I still need to go home, there's the word. I want to travel home at this time. We develop a protection plan, and that can take on various types of forms on how to survive that visit home, whether it be shortening it, or staying at a motel and only going into the house at certain times, or so forth and so on. I mean, the list, and it's individualized, and they go with that list. The difficulty that they have to also deal with, and I also warn them, is that they don't have to do their list perfectly, because they're so used to doing this perfectly. And so even if they come up with three or four things they're going to do for that, they need to know, and we need to know, that we don't have to do any of this perfectly. That's.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, John. So it's time now to respond and to begin to help one another think through ideas that have been tried or that you currently yourselves have practiced that might be helpful to others to know how to unplug this Christmas machine as it's begun to be described here. Yes?
Well, one thing at a level that's not especially deep or challenging to the whole concept of the way things are done, but which I think nevertheless would improve the situation for people's lives, as well as the whole mess of commercialism and the intensity of that time, is simply, okay, if you are going to get gifts for people, either make them or buy them, well, why not do that all year round? I've done that. 1 year I got my Christmas shopping all done by February 4th, December. Had everything decided as what I'll give for a Christmas gift. It seems like a real easy thing. I mean, most of the time I don't end up doing it, but that 1 year, I actually did manage it, and it was great. And so Christmas in July, well, Christmas all year round. I mean, it is supposed to be something that's kind of a more constant state of mind and heart anyway, so for what it's worth, that's an idea that should be
Christmas, you forget what you bought and where you put it. And then after right over me, that's true. And then you ask, yeah, I was so organized, I bought things all along the trip and something. I still haven't found one calendar in Berlin. The little teddy bears, and I knew. So that's a problem. Now I started a box for Christmas and for Christmas. It's a good idea.
Yes.
I do that, and what I like so much about it is that it keeps me out of the malls from October on. And for me, that's really, it keeps me away from all that commercialism. I think that's really, I've done that for a number of years, and I haven't started yet this year, but that's just to keep you out of the mall.
Yeah, we have a little more time also to think about something that really is meaningful, and just sort of keep an eye out once in a while, instead of making some mad rush at the last minute for some token thing that isn't.
And yet, every Christmas Eve, on the news at about 7 o'clock or 6:30, they always, one of the neat little features that they think is real cool is to show that last person, and they always interview this last person who's doing that last minute shopping in the mall, you know, and it's.
Oh yeah, I always wait till about 5 o'clock in the afternoon to come in and I go, well, this sounds wonderful, and I'm done, you know, and every Christmas Eve, just check out your local news sometime. They always want to interview that last person into the mall.
By the time everything is marked down.
Oh, yeah. You don't shop, you just go in and buy. It doesn't matter.
Yes.
Well, one year my daughter suggested instead of giving each other presents, we would meet, and we're from all over, you know, country. So we got together and had a cross-country skiing weekend, and that really was great.
Where did you do that? Where was the cross-country skiing weekend?
Mount Hood.
So it was on... It was on neutral turf then, more or less.
Mm-hmm.
It was at no one's home.
Where we all live.
Was everybody able to do it?
I mean, yeah.
That's good. That might be a little unusual, though.
Yes.
I bought that book, and it's neat, and I need to get it and read it every year. We're still struggling with the gift thing, and one year we told our children that this is when they were adults. This was only like. Not that many years ago, maybe 5 years ago, that for Christmas this year we would take everybody to Holden Village.
Mm.
So we did. Our whole family was, well, our whole five of us were here. And it was really special. It was probably, we still say this is the best Christmas we've ever had, is the one we spent at Holden. So that was another, you know, that was the same idea where you just get away and do something else completely.
Were you up here during Christmas or were you up here?
Yeah, we came a couple days before Christmas and stayed. You know, a few days after.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing I liked the best was that at Holden they do Advent up till the 24th. And then we started getting ready for Christmas, and it was very much fun and it was exciting. We decorated the tree, and that was when this was the winter dining room and this was the only building that was being used, and there was like 100 people in the village. And it was a very, very special Christmas.
Some people have found doing, believe this or not, doing volunteer work during that time, during the holiday season, or even volunteering at either a food bank or a shelter of some sort, or at a hospital on Christmas Eve, so that their staff, you know, doesn't have to be there, or on Christmas Day, and have found great meaning.
Or serving at the meals for the hungry.
I know David wants to, but Linda, I know, has a story in response to what you just said. Tell the story that you told me about working
there
in
was,
a shelter.
There was.
Some people don't find great.
There was a year after I had recently moved to a community when I found that I was going to be alone on Christmas Eve, and I thought, well, this is really an opportunity rather than moping about what I usually do on Christmas Eve, that, you know, I would do that very thing and serve at a food bank or a mission. And so I set aside the whole day and the evening, and then I began to call organizations. And I called every organization that I knew of in what's the biggest city in Indiana and received the same response. Well, we really can't use your help, but if you'd like to send a donation, money will be fine. So
there was no room for her at all.
No room.
No room in the inn, right?
I have a similar
And quick to say, but please, you know, send money, which, it, you know, it's for a good cause, but it still kind of goes back to the dollar sign thing of Christmas.
I tried to do the same thing at a Thanksgiving where it turned out I would be alone, and at the, although I went down to the shelter, they said, sure, come, now's when to come. There were probably three people serving for every homeless person.
Everybody comes out on the day.
That's right.
And I've heard, you know, from some of the Seattle shelters, you know, everybody shows up at this time. We'd like to have you in June and July, you know, type of bit too.
David?
Well, we do something that's not unusual. I think a lot of families do. We take our extended family and draw names, and so everyone is giving a gift for one person rather than, you know, all the cousins and all the aunts and uncles and nephews and nieces. And we do it early enough in the year, like, you know, springtime, so that each person can focus on one member of the family for whom you get to buy the gift, and you can shop and think about it and pick out something that's just right and put your resources in one special gift instead of buying trinkets for everybody.
And it's intergenerational. We don't separate the adults from the kids, and that's been real interesting, and then not help people buy things. I'd like to add one of the things that I think would be important. I don't know how well it works, but I think especially when children get older and then they marry and you've got other families that they're needing to connect to, and all of us have experienced that at some time, I think we should look them in the eye and say, you know, do what's best for you at Christmas. We don't expect you to have to be with us. We'll be fine. You make your choice. Because I think too many kids, and we've all been there, where you have this expectation that you have to be both sets of families somehow, you have to even it up, and you're running around and maybe never having a Christmas, creating a Christmas or a tradition of your own. And I don't know, we tried to do that. I don't know if the kids believe us, but we did say, you know, if you have to be with the other family for Christmas, that's fine with us, and we won't feel bad about it. We'd love to have you here anytime you can, but don't think you have.
Other suggestions? I have one that was brought to mind when David spoke about drawing names. There's one family in Valparaiso, where I live, who many years ago, as their children were getting about to the point that they were leaving the nest and so on, they decided to find an attorney and draw up some papers and found a family foundation. And so they have all contributions at Christmas given to this family foundation, which they kind of put together, and all the children who have people giving them gifts have those gifts be the same thing. And then when the family gets together, they talk about what to do with that seed money for that foundation. They've done a lot of amazing things with that seed money that started those many years ago when they were deciding what to do and how to unplug the Christmas machine. And that seed money has done an amazing number of things. That's the, some folks here will know the Reiners and the number of things they've done in Valparaiso, and some of that money has come from this Reiner Foundation, which they started when they were trying to figure out what to do to unplug the Christmas machine. So that's not something our family does, but something a family we know does, and something we've talked about to them.
What I'd like to know what individuals do for themselves. We've heard some family suggestions, but what do anybody, you know, what do the people here do for themselves during this time to make it special? Even in the context of having family around, there are times where you can do some individual stuff. You know?
Well, one of the most meaningful things for me is Wednesday, we meet on Wednesday, so the last time before Christmas, we had a very cool manger, and we always ask ourselves what we can give to Jesus, which is usually something we have to get rid of ourselves. I mean, we really, attitude or whatever, it's something, but that's very meaningful, and then we try to find a symbol or something for that to put it, or write it on a piece of paper, make it a scroll, and put it in the manger. And give it, and that's very meaningful, so that you give something of yourself and think about it.
Yes?
I usually try to do something that gets me more in touch with nature. I guess one of my favorite ones was one Christmas, got up before dawn and climbed up a mountain. Our family was staying down at a place called the Peaks of Otter in Virginia. It's down in the southern part of the Blue Ridge Parkway, and climbed Sharp Top Mountain and before dawn, before sunrise, and watched the sunrise up on top. That was really something.
One of the best things about Christmas for my family is going to concerts and participating in music. So we've made it a point to go to a lot of concerts during Christmas season and to buy extra tickets and take people along. We have some friends that don't have a dime, so it's really easy to, you know, find people to take along.
I don't know if this is part of what you triggered it in my mind talking about the Reiners. When you're a writer, you don't know what your income is going to be year to year. So Pat and I always identify a tithe at the beginning of the year and a parish unto whom that tithe is. But if a book sells in a year, then all of a sudden there's an income you hadn't anticipated. And what we do throughout the year is, Fan does it, I hope. She keeps a record of what money above our pledged tithe has come in during that year. And then it's always, it turns out to be the Christmas season. And I hadn't made that conjunction at the beginning of this process, but it began to be part of it, because you have to do it before the end of the year. We've saved up ideas of people or individuals or families or whoever who may benefit by a gift that they never anticipated. And generally for us, it means some of that extra money, which we will tithe at the end of the year, goes to places that other people would think of, and that is food banks and so forth. But often it means that we try to watch throughout the year for people individually who are destitute or in trouble or whatever. And it's at that end of the year then that we will write a letter and send a check and then not think so much in terms of what's not for profit, but just the tithe. And that has become, for us, just a wonderful thing to do for an evening sitting down and finally making these decisions.
Other ideas?
Will churches do any?
Oh, kind of.
Is there anyone here from Spokane?
Close, it'll be late.
Well, we stayed overnight in Spokane on our way out here, and I talked to someone about the running sculpture down at the Central Park, and I was told what the city of Spokane does with that in the wintertime. Some of you have seen this. It's a the sculpture, life-size sculpture of really a couple dozen runners finishing a race. So here are all these 20 or 30 bronze human figures running a race. I was told that at Christmas time the people of Spokane give to the community winter clothing, and that the city takes clothing down and puts it on all those figures, coats and hats and mittens and scarves. And these are for the people who need them to come and just take whatever fits and whatever they need off of this piece of public art. And then the next day it's replenished with another set of stocking caps and coats. It was just sounded like a nice civic way of getting things out to those who need it.
I thought it was beautiful because so many people, when they need things, it's humiliating for them to ask, and they'll do without instead. But if they know it's there for them, they'll go and see what fits them and change it. I was just surprised.
Yes.
One thing I never forget, I must have been 4 or 5 years old. I wanted another doll for Christmas. And my mother said, then I had to give one away to poor children. And I still remember to this day where the people live, my doll's name, Martin, when I gave it to them and the family's name, and I said, here's my doll, Martin. And I must have been like 4 or 5. And I think, I've often thought about it, I think these children today wanting more and more and give me, if they would do something like that, give something away that's meaningful to them and bring it themselves to the children that need it, you don't forget that. And it helps to appreciate what you have, what do you really want and need more.
I have found that this ties in a bit to what you said and what someone else said. I have found one thing that is sometimes helpful in thinking of gifts is to, and I guess in my experience it's worked best with family members, but it would be to save the children and other enterprises like that. It helps if you adopt a child in their name and put them in touch with another part of the world, another human being, etc. Something that they would not necessarily have done themselves, but then that they have that kind of correspondence and communication all year, that sometimes is a way of spreading some Christmas spirit in ways that you otherwise might not. Your churches, you mentioned, Tim, I think, in passing, that the church ought to be helpful in addressing some of these issues that you raised. Do you have any examples yourself of things churches have done to address this whole difficulty?
Well, what I was alluding to is I think the church needs to, and church leadership, pastors, teachers, whatever, also, and their congregations need to realize that they have a lot of people within their pews where the holiday season isn't necessarily that joyous, or there are some difficulties around that, and they need to be aware of that. And I think they need to be aware then of the language that they use and the symbolisms and so forth and so on that go on, and maybe offer within the congregation alternative type of gatherings, for us. And seems people who do not want to travel or can't travel home, where are they going to be, and are they going to be, by themselves and stuff, and some type of groupings that way is one thing that comes to mind. Single parents, the holiday seasons for single parents can be very devastating because they just cannot provide what the shopping malls and TV said we need to have and so forth and so on. It can be a real, real difficult time, and I just think Congress needs to be aware of that type of situation. I don't know, I can't think of right now of any other ways to address it, and I think some other people probably give some suggestions.
It occurs to me that one of the reasons why Christmas falls so flat for so many people is that what they're trying to do is to recapture what for many of them was an intense joy as children.
Or should have been an intense joy for them as children.
Well, but that's the thing. I think for many, many children, even in the most destitute circumstances, and even in dysfunctional families, there are those moments.
Yeah.
Those individual moments of a sort of a pure and unexpected graceful joy.
Mm-hmm.
Those moments that were unanticipated are the ones that are remembered most profoundly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they do come around certain celebrations, and they come around the Christmas time. Gifts do that. I mean, kids are so simple. You give them a gift, they're happy.
Give them the box, they'll be happy too.
Well, and so you see what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Now, what I'd like to go from there is, maybe part of the fallacy is that once we are adults, we recapture that for ourselves. I don't know that we ever recapture that graceful surprise for ourselves. It comes as grace, and it comes as somebody else's happy, all kinds of things. But when we work at it, maybe the thing to be worked at is to make that the gift for the next generation, and not this personal recapturing, whether we're single parents, whether we're no parents at all, but somebody else's children, or whether we're in a parish. So that, for me, I know that there were those moments as a child. I know that it was such intense feeling that I was just tipping between great laughter and great tears. I could suddenly become pathetic with tears if it didn't work out right. But nevertheless, there were the flashes and shards of joy. And I find this, even in the most poverty-stricken and dysfunctional families, they will remember a moment in their childhood, which I conceive to be pure grace. It's a gift from God. So that one of the finest ways, perhaps, to unplug that machine is to cease to recapture for oneself that moment, which may or may not ever come, but you don't work at it. It's like the mystics. You don't work at it and make it happen. It comes as a gift.
Yeah.
But what you can do is work at it for a child. And you can set up a circumstance in which that child has that moment for all the rest of her life.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes no matter what your relationships are, your family, certainly for your own children, but also if you're in a parish and you're in a relationship, then it comes for other children. And if it becomes therefore that sort of a gift, that seeking, and not to overwhelm them with gifts, because even though, you know, they're hungry for that sort of thing, often it is just that flash, it's just that moment.
It's that sense of awe. Grace. It's that sense of awe as a child.
And I'd like to make a distinction between that and the worship of Christmas, which we as adults can be involved in very, very much, in the Advent and the Nativity and that sort of thing, which is a little bit different from this recapturing of the Christmas spirit. They go together, they may abet one another, but they're not necessarily the same thing. And as an adult, it may be for me a dry white season.
See, I remember as a child some of those Christmas pageant programs, whatever. And I can think back and I get goosebumps thinking about it. Then as an education director in Lucan Parishes for about 15 years, I dreaded those things. Because I think, as you were saying, I was trying to recapture that old thing. I couldn't do that.
Give it away. Give it away.
You know. And once I got to the point in the latter part of that career aspect of letting that go, and I don't consciously remember saying to myself, I'm going to let that aspect go, but I think it just kind of evolved into that. Then they became the joyous sense of awe, that moment, those moments of grace, and sure, in enjoyment, you know. So I appreciate what you were saying, because that just triggered a lot of that. So.
Linda?
I think, too, if we sometimes make a point to expand our sense of what the family is, or what a family could be, and several people have mentioned, you know, people that are alone at the holidays, whether it be elderly people, single parents, and in planning traditions and the things that we do, to think about that in a broader way. Some of the best holidays that I've had, the one that I remember is really just kind of an afterthought. I thought of an elderly woman in town that had done some ironing for me, and I knew she didn't drive at night. I thought, you know, I'll just call and see if she wants to go to Christmas Eve service. Well, that turned out to be, you know, just the biggest thing that had happened for her, and it was such a small thing for me to do, to take her to church, to have her at the house for a while, and one of the, you know, most special Christmases that I've had. So, you know, for those of us that have experienced some Christmases alone, think about others that might be in that same spot.
Yes, ma'am, then Dan.
Right. I was just thinking along the same lines. I was the youngest of a large family, and we usually got one present in a stocking filled with candy and things. But Christmas was always a real, well, we always went to church. I grew up in a very German Lutheran church. Church was always primary, but it was always very much of a family time together. And it just seemed like there was always something going on. The house was full. There was a lot of activity. We always had a real tree, and we decorated it. And it was just a very exciting time, and a time that we always looked forward to. And after I was married and had a family of my own, it was much the same. And it was always family time. Everybody always got together. And of course, my sisters and brothers all had kids, and it was like people and confusion and fun, and not so much presents, but being together and just having a really special time, and we play games and we, you know, eat and just have fun together. But it wasn't so much in spending money as it was being together, and that's always been very important to me, and it still is. But unfortunately, everybody grew up, and my father died, I was divorced, everybody's kids grew up and moved away, and it's turned out to be a very lonely time, and it's very difficult. And I have tried. I spent the last two Christmases alone and crying, but I too have tried doing things, and that's really what's pulled me through. And I think that I worked in dinner and, you know, trying to always be available for someone else. And I think that's really the answer, is you have to not think of yourself.
And so I found that as I became an adult and spent some Christmases alone as an adult, that it was kind of like something really good had been lost. That was forever gone, and I would never get it back, and I think that that's been true. But what I found is I've come to the realization that Christmas is not, after all, the most important time of the year. For me, it's Easter. And so, really, the high point for me in the year, the time when I really focus on what Christmas is all about, is during Lent and Easter. And that's been very helpful to me to just kind of, Christmas is a time when you mix secular and religious together, because the birth of Jesus was not the most important thing. It was that dying and the resurrection that was the most important thing. And that's been very helpful to help ease the Christmas thing. Because then I can do some, you know, just some of the fun things. But at Easter time, you don't have all the trappings, and you can just, I mean, you can be right there. And that's just been a tremendous help to kind of, you know, take away the disappointments that sometimes we feel about Christmas as adults.
Hmm. Other ideas? Comments? Yes.
Last Christmas was my first Christmas entirely alone. My children weren't even with me on Christmas last year, which was a big shock. So I did think of myself. I said, what will be deeply nourishing? And so I decided to make a retreat, as the Catholics would say, during the last couple days, actually during that week before Christmas and on through Christmas. And then Christmas Day, after church, I left town and went to Seattle to see a friend of mine. Stayed with her for a couple days, and we played Scrabble around the fire nonstop. And one person we were playing Scrabble with used all seven letters in the first move of two successive games. But anyhow, that wasn't the point of the story. I do remember. I got in touch with a Catholic priest I knew in town who had no parish responsibilities. He had other responsibilities, and said, what should I do for a retreat? He basically said, well, do a retreat at home, stay home, gather around you the things that you want, pick a couple things you might like to do, pick some scripture you'd like to focus on, and just sort of go with the flow. And so I did. I knit for a while, and I looked at the tree, which was beautiful, and I walked everywhere. I didn't drive anywhere the last week before Christmas, so I didn't go, except to a couple parties. I didn't go anywhere except on foot. And so it was a completely different texture of Christmas right at the end. And I listened to a lot of music and not to the television at all, but CDs of my choice. And survived, not only survived, but flourished in fine style. So
I just have to tell you what just popped into my mind as we're talking. We're currently living in a travel trailer because we're waiting for our house to get finished being built. And we've been in it since last November, about Thanksgiving time. And I had a very liberated Christmas this last Christmas because I couldn't put a tree in my house. So we had a little tiny planted one that we bought outside the window where the booth is that you sit down to eat. And we didn't have to decorate it or anything. And I did cook a Christmas dinner, but it was only for four people because that's all we could fit. And and one of them was an old lady, and the other one was a guy that didn't have anywhere else to be. And it was really fun. We didn't have to do. I didn't bake. I didn't do anything. And it was really fun. I think the tradition we have in our family for Christmas is that we do something different every year. And that's good for us.
And you may enjoy that so much that next Christmas you'll probably move back into the trailer.
Well, one other year we didn't stay home on Christmas. We went to church, and then we took off to go see relatives, mm-hmm. a long way away. And at time for dinner, we were in Wenatchee, so we went to a place to eat, and the only thing that was open was the Red Lion. So we went in and had dinner, and there were all these other people that were kind of doing the same thing, and it was a real nice feeling, and we left a big tip for the waitress who wasn't real thrilled about working on Christmas and tried to cheer her up, and it was really fun.
Well, I think we've reached a natural moment of not so much closure, but time to disband and continue this conversation in other places. I want to thank Tim and Joan and thank everyone else who's contributed ideas and stories. I'm always convinced at forums, but I guess I'm convinced again at this one, that if these kinds of conversations went on more in our local parishes, they would be more about the business of the sorts of things parishes ought to be about. That is to say, to use the word that Tim couldn't pronounce, demythologize.
Thank you. Merry Christmas. That was a gift.
I'll call you this Christmas and just say, demythologize. What I was trying to use the word demythologize to get at is that just opening up in community to the fact that people do feel, for many different reasons, grim and sad often over the holiday season, and that they are have been inventive out of different stories in coping with that and are eager to reach out and help others cope, is already to be sort of liberated. That is, already to not have to work collectively at maintaining this myth and pretense that everybody else but me is just carrying on in a kind of joyful and euphoric kind of tone. And I think a lot of people work so hard at maintaining that facade to themselves and others that they don't sort of reach out and do the sorts of things that we've done tonight a bit to help each other.
Well, one final word. The bookstore, Jeanette Hasseru, put out a special table of ideas for Christmas celebrations, including some of the resources from Alternatives in Ellenwood, Georgia. And this is the place where you can order the bulletin inserts, the suggestions for how your parish can celebrate Christmas in a more ethical way, and how your family might consider doing it too. So you can either check out the pamphlets over there or copy down the address here and write to them yourself if you want to follow up on that.
Now, is that the same place to write for this?
No.
Okay.
It's not. This book is available. I don't know if that's in the bookstore or not. This book is from the library here. So.
But they sell it in the bookstore.
Yeah, that's where you're going.
Good night, folks. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
1 year or more.
I guess I didn't realize last year that you had just got book in this
book. Yeah.
And
right,
I somehow thought that you, I felt you'd been there for some time.
Yeah, people think I fit Campus Ministry. Well, I think I did too. But anyway, I had some friends who said, Campus Ministry, why didn't they do that? Finally.
John.
Oh, well, I succeeded John. There was another person in it for about 6 months.
Yeah,
I do.
And I'm still in touch with John.
What's he doing?
He's a parish pastor, St. Paul Lutheran Church, downtown Vancouver, Crossage. Finished his master's in history.
I would have. I dropped out of the system. We were both out of Missouri Synod, and I dropped out of the system earlier, but we would have been through seminars together.
Well, John and I went to exactly the same seminary at exactly the same year, so I was at seminars too.
Really? Do you have the degree that had my dad's name on it?
No. I finished at Lutheran Northwestern last week, so took our last year there.
I don't know if you find that people don't have flash of awe and wonder, but I don't know that I have any at Christmas time while saying that.
Yeah.
And
oh, I know people don't have flashes of awe.
one thing I do at Christmas time is I make sure I'm in therapy to get me through it.
I understand.
So I didn't say it to everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing.
Good night.
Good night.
When did you finish and look them up?
78.
I went through, I went to Northwestern before the merger. I took a master's in historical theology because I had these ideas that I would like to do in the church history. I didn't have any, didn't want to be ordained. No way. That wasn't it. And that was fun. I got through my own program, basically. And then I got applied to three graduate schools, got accepted, and decided I didn't want to do that. So I went in the parish, worked as a, started out as a youth director, education director, and did that for 15 years. Got my counseling degree in the process, because I figured pretty quick that I didn't understand.
Right.
There's certain dynamics going on here that I just throw beyond. Then I got ordained leaving the parish. My call was to St. Luke Health Ministries.
But you founded that, didn't you?
Yeah. Did.
Yeah.
Sponsored by your synod?
No. The medical director is Dr. Ken Bach, and he has two books on holistic health in the bookstore here. One is A Call to Wholeness, Health is a Spiritual Journey, and The Journey Toward Wholeness, Christ-Centered Approach to Health and Healing.
Mm-hmm.
And based on those two, several of us got together, and he's the medical director, and I'm the director of counseling. We started 4 years ago, in coming September, three of us put our little houses up on the line to secure a loan to open up the clinic. It's been ups and downs, but we're doing really great now. So we're up to the staff, about 26 people. So we deal primarily with chronic pain, and which people come with chronic physical pain, and after that's been really addressed from the chronic emotional pain that starts emerging. And addictions, we do outpatient relapse prevention and addiction work. And we have two full-time doctors, Ken and then Dr. Charlie Thompson, who's a nationally certified addictionologist. We have biofeedback, behavioral medicine, we have six physical therapists. So we do a lot of deep tissue memory work with people at their request. Which means, and we've done this a couple times, all six of our PTs are very sensitive to childhood trauma, and four of them are in recovery themselves, so they're very sensitive to that. We deal with that deep tissue memory, because we're firm believers of that nothing escapes our bodies, and it gets stored someplace and goes deep into our memory, which tends to click out, or deep into our body. Tissue itself. So we do conjoint type of work, physical therapy, massage therapy, talk therapy. And then we have four counselors, four therapists, and have five satellite counseling offices and churches. Nutrition counseling, and have a doctor, Oriental Medicine, who does acupuncture for us. That's what we're about. What's interesting, because when people, we get resumes all the time from around the United States of all this, because they track down Ken mostly through his books. These books are being used on university levels and medical schools, a few, and seminaries and stuff like that. And he gets, so we get resumes all the time. And if we're looking for a certain person, they or they come in and they say, I really would like working, here's ours, or something, they have to read Ken's books, and then if they can find themselves within the parameters of that, then we talk some more. And a lot of physicians who really like what we do can't go that extra step in dealing with that whole aspect of it. And so we don't, you know, we could have financially been much further along than we are, and so forth and so on, and plays and stuff, because there were some real predominant physicians in the Seattle area that were real fascinated with our concept and working with people, but they couldn't. After they talk with Ken and read through some of the stuff, they couldn't accept that spiritual aspect of it, and that all the real total connectedness between emotion and mental, and just was a different
But within that context, we have one person who's in, who's Muslim, and two people who are active in the Jewish faith within our clinic. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
A lot of burned out Catholics and burned out Lutherans.
Yeah.
Few Assembly of Goders, and so forth and so on. So it makes for great discussion around staff meetings and
conversation.
And when we had staff meeting, discuss the Gulf War, to hear the two people, the Jewish and the Muslim, who's from Persia, talking. It's been neat stuff. So.
Do you know any of Charlie May's work? Patient's Ordeal is his latest book. First one was on physicians. He's a biomedical ethicist at SMU.
Ken May.
Bill May.
I was going to say Charlie May.
Yeah, so. Charlie May's the pastor. That's why I'm at Holden, so I was thinking Charlie May. William May.
Yeah, yeah.
This latest one, The Patient's Ordeal, is basically attempting to, it takes classic cases of different patients who suffered different kinds of trauma and attempts to, because he's always written from the point of view of a clinician, of the medical practitioner, mm-hmm. whether it's a doctor or the nurses or the mm-hmm. technologists and so forth, or the whole general quandary ethic type of things, but not really talked about matters from the patient's perspective. And so mm-hmm. he's really worked for years on this patient's ordeal thing. And finally, I mean, the payoff of the book is that he takes up these cases, and finally, it demonstrates pretty much through these close clinical case studies that absent a vocabulary that has spiritual depth and resonance, you can't even describe what these people experience. I mean, that the vocabulary of modern medicine can't even name the reality that these people face. I mean, absent death and resurrection, for example, you can't talk about the Dax case of burn. Severe burn victim. I mean, that really what you're talking about is a death of the old person and a resurrection of a new being.
Well, that's interesting.
You're not talking about continuity. Mm-hmm. And that the vocabulary of medical practice still wants to talk about continuities and repairing this and fixing that and so forth and so forth. So unless you have something pretty powerful and profound with all kinds of traumas that humans undergo, mm-hmm. such as death and resurrection mm-hmm. language, mm-hmm. you just can't even name what's happening, much mm-hmm. less minister to mm-hmm. it. And so, and he saves all of that for the last chapter, mm-hmm. so that, you know, you kind of read these clinical studies from the patient's mm-hmm. point of view, mm-hmm. and then he says, look what we've done to try to even reconstruct what their experience is in their own voice.